This is the Tan Talk Radio Network.
Hi, this is Patsy with a Z. Welcome to Joy on Paper, a program for writers and those who dream of writing, and for everyone who wants to know the story behind the book. Coming to you from glorious Clearwater, Florida, the perfect place for writers to write and readers to enjoy a good book. April is Poetry Month, and at the bottom of the hour, I am going to have a very special poet read her own work, and Kim Dower is a favorite here on Joy on Paper. She's been a guest, and so she's going to read one of her poems today for us. But right now, we're going to have the story behind the book. I am so happy to welcome to Joy on Paper Robert Dagoni, and the name of his new book is Her Deadly Game. Are you there, Robert?
I am indeed. Good morning. How are you?
Good morning. Well. I have to play something for you, okay? I have a little something I'm playing for you.
Okay.
A drum roll, because you deserve it.
Well, thank you very much.
This is the birth of a new series, I'm sure. This is, I don't know what I could do with you today, because I could spend the whole time just saying, you're brilliant. I knew you were brilliant before, but now you're more brilliant.
Well, thank you. That's very kind of you.
This book is so good. It is brilliant. What am I going to do with you? Her Deadly Game. Oh, this is a deadly game. I tell you, there's so many things about this book it's perfect. I love legal thrillers generally, but, you know, there's legal thrillers, and then there's this. You write in what I call a rat-a-tat-tat form. Now, that's also, for me, it's very funny that when I started reading the book, I said, this is rat-a-tat-tat, which is also a term I use in chess, because it is when things are just coming so fast, boom, 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 one thing after another, and, you know, it's not a real chess term, but that's, when you play with somebody who's doing that, it's really exciting. And you're writing that way. You just write one thing after another. It just pulls us in and pulls us in and pulls us in. And it's so clean and it's so beautifully done. It just took my breath away.
Well, thank you. Yeah, you know, I mean, that's the goal with a thriller, right? Whatever you're writing, a legal thriller, a police procedural thriller, whatever it is, you want it to thrill people. You want to have them, you know, keep turning the page and turning the page and not give them an opportunity to have a breather and put the book down.
Well, exactly. I started this on a Sunday afternoon, and I didn't have a breather. I mean, I was like, I had to get up a few times, but nature called. Other than that, I didn't want to stop. It is just so good, and I want to really, I need to thank somebody really special in your life. And she deserves this recognition. I play a drum roll for her. Gracie Doyle is brilliant.
She really is. I really have found a home at Amazon Publishing. And, you know, Gracie is not only a great editor, but she's just a great sounding board for me. I will call her up and I'll say, I have an idea for a book. Here's kind of what I want to do. And in this particular instance, she said to me, I'd really love to see you do another legal thriller. She said, you're very good in the courtroom. Your scenes in the courtroom are, you know, really, really kind of your best writing. Can you do a legal thriller, but incorporate all the other things that you love to do, which is police procedurals and family dynamics? And so I came up with Kira Dugan and the Dugan family. And I came up with a case for her to defend for her law firm, which is her father's law firm, which is Bailey. And I gave her you know, her own personal skeletons in her closet. You know, she comes from an alcoholic household.
Well, okay, we're not gonna go through all of that. I'll tell you one thing. This is so good. You created from just everything that you've done, but now you've wrapped it all into this wonderful, wonderful family dynamics, which you're so good at anyway. I mean, ever since, where you have
The Ordinary Life of Sam
Yeah.
Hill.
You're so good at particularly doing families at dinner, that kind of thing. You're great at that. So here you have this opportunity to create this family, and they are so fascinating, and you've left so many, there's so many things you're going to be doing with this family. It is the start of a series. I'm not wrong, right?
No, you're not. You're not. It is the start of a series, yes.
I'd have to come over there and hit you on the head with a book if you weren't going to continue, because, I mean, this is just too good. I mean, sometimes everything just falls in place, and things just fell in place for you with this one. This is just so good. First of all, of course, the name, Her Deadly Game. I'm not going to tell everybody what is in this book, but, you know, as I said, for me, and I had no idea there was going to be anything to do with anything about chess in it or any, but when I had this feeling, this rat-a-tat-tat, I love that kind of writing. This takes my breath away, and I said, wow, and she's right, Gracie's right about you are great at courtroom, because what happens in so many legal thrillers, where it falls down, is that evidence has to be repeated over and over in many different iterations. And
right.
So often it becomes so boring, it becomes so repetitive, so redundant, but you make everything fresh.
Well, thank you. Yeah, I mean, that's the goal, right? I mean, anybody who's tried cases will tell you that it's 95% drudgery and 5% interesting, and I try to write the 5%.
Well, you certainly have. And as you said, Kira Duggan and the entire family, her father, Patsy, which is Patsy with a S-Y, as opposed to my name, which is with a Z-I, Patsy. But I do get, it's funny, because my name is Patsy, a lot of times people will think that I must be Irish.
Right.
But it's so funny. I love the Irish accent, and so I don't mind. And as a matter of fact, when I started Joy on Paper, I just celebrated the 8th anniversary. I started the program on St. Patrick's Day.
Oh, wow.
So it all sort of blends in.
Yeah, it's symbiotic, right?
Exactly. And that wonderful thing, of course, now, as I said, with this family, I love that you gave them enough kids there. So we're going to have stories. It's just, I got such a kick out of it as I'm reading that. I'm thinking, I know he's writing this, you know, when he starts, he's writing it as one book, but he's got to keep with this story. But it's all sort of building up this family dynamics, which you are so good at.
Thank you. Thank you very much. I appreciate it.
I mean, I remember back with my sister's grave, which was, of course, your big sort of breakthrough thing. Oh, everything about your writing is great. But this one, this book, I just felt, woo! I'm flying with this book.
Thank you. Thank you. That's the goal. I wanted to make it fun. I wanted readers to have an enjoyable experience. I wanted it to be a puzzle book. I wanted it to be a game. And I'm glad that you enjoyed it.
It is. Everything is. Everything about it, it's just perfect. And, you know, I'm the kind of person who, when I get a book, I read from the beginning. I never read on the back cover. I never read blurbs. I never want to know what it's about before I start. I don't want to know anything about the family. I don't want to know anything about the characters until I discover it as I turn the pages. So, but I do always read the beginning. I always read the dedications. I know the dedications because I think that's important. And I always read, if I love when writers put a little something, a little quote at the beginning. Now, most people will sort of just slide over the quote, won't even think about it. But you can't catch me. Oh, boy, oh, boy. You know, I've been in the theater, and I've been in, I lived in England, so I knew, I'm not going to tell what and why that's important, but it just, everything, I just felt, as I was reading, I thought, oh, he's having so much fun writing this book.
I did. I had a ball, and you know, you hit the nail on the head. Reading should be a process of discovery. That's what makes it fun for readers. They try to predict what's going to happen, and then you hopefully can surprise them with a new discovery. So it was a ball writing the book, and I'm looking forward to writing the next one in the series.
Well, exactly that. And that's why I get so annoyed with all those blurbs that they have. You know, people judge a book nowadays by the blurb on, you know, online. And if it doesn't sound interesting, then they're not going to read it, you know. The joy of it is to know when you have a really great writer. They know you're a great writer. All they have to do is pick up the book and start turning the pages. And then after, when they get to about page 30 and they say, well, I'm getting thirsty and I can't get up. you know you got a great book.
Yeah, thank you. It's very kind. That's the goal.
So, you know, it's so funny. I have to keep, what can I say? That people have to get this book. I don't know, I'm sure you have blurby kind of things that you're giving to people, but I don't like to give it away. I really don't. People read the book, I mean, one page after another. As I said, as you're getting, we'll just tell you that Kira is fascinating, and the entire family is fascinating. I love Patsy. And when you start really caring about people, when you start caring about the characters from you know, just within a few chapters, you really care. You're worried. You built up this tension of what's going to happen to various members of the family, too, as we're going along. And it's so exciting.
Well, yeah, thank you. I mean, that's the goal, is to make your characters empathetic. You know, if you can make them sympathetic, that's one thing. But if you can make them empathetic and you can get the reader to stand in your character's shoes, whether that's the protagonist or whether that's, you know, one of the family members, they'll relate to the book, they'll relate to the characters, and they'll relate to the story. I think the biggest compliment anyone can pay me is when they close a book and they say to me, is this a true story? Is this based on true story? Did something happen like this? Because that means that you really did capture them. They really did feel like they were part of the book.
Well, it's funny, you know, as I'm reading the story too, it brought back to mind, now, I have a love-hate relationship with lawyers. I was involved in a terrible lawsuit back in the day in Hollywood, where I sued a major film company.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, that was a big mistake. When you're young and you believe you're right, you know, you are right. And you, I'm not believe, you know you're right. You know that is your work. You wrote it and somebody stole it. But then when you hire the nephew of a friend who just got out of law school, and you walk into the boardroom of a major law firm, you know you've lost. So over the years, I've sort of been working on a side story about, how can I say, a story where every lawyer in the boardroom is murdered in some wonderful way. And maybe someday I will publish it. But I'm always afraid if I do publish it, they'll sue me and I'll be back. So
nobody wins in a lawsuit. Nobody wins. I tried enough civil cases to know that, you know, when the case is done, you know, the client's not fully happy, the opposite side is not fully happy, and unfortunately, that's where how our justice system works and operates, but it's still the best justice system in the world. So.
Oh, it is. And I love the courtroom scenes. I love when lawyers are questioning and, you know, it's just, it's so good. And when you write this, it just boom, 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 rat-a-tat-tat, beautiful. Just one after another, you just take us away with this what you know, the examination, the cross-examination, it's perfect.
Well, thank you. It's, you know, it's not an easy skill, and I've had the fortune of trying some cases with some really good lawyers, and, you know, when you watch a really good lawyer do his job well, it's really fascinating, and it's really entertaining, and that's what I was trying to do. I was trying to put a lawyer in the courtroom who's very, very good at what she does and allow the reader to see the intuitiveness that that she displays and her ability to adapt, you know, all those things. But that came, again, from spending time in the courtroom with some really, really talented people and trying to emulate them.
Well, you captured it, because, as you said, it's not easy. And, again, this is one of the, you know, you have legal thrillers, they have a premise, they have a, I mean, your premise is the easiest of all. It's such a simple case, and yet you have done so much with it. And so there's a when the courtroom scenes came up, I said to myself, oh my goodness, this is so great. And it reminded me, now of course you've been to London, have you ever gone to Old Bailey?
To where? Excuse
me. The court in London, all the court cases are in Old Bailey. Oh, next time you go, you have to go. You have to go and watch.
I do.
You have to watch them. As a matter of fact, one of the cases I watched, you can get in there. You can get in Old Bailey. You can sit in the gallery and you can watch them working. And I mean, they are good. They are very, and they're literate too. So you have to sometimes be really smart, because they actually, I wouldn't, you know, they use literary terms sometimes and refer. It's very good. They're very fast. But there was a lawyer in there, an Irish lawyer. A solicitor, as they call. And he was so good, so fast, and witty. It was absolute joy to watch, and around the corner, because I have a real passion for Irish accents. I can listen to Irish people talk all day. So, but that, you know, for you, because you're so famous, when you get to London next time, go to Old Bailey. Not only will you, you'll sit in the gallery and watch some cases, but they'll give you the grand tour, which is, I mean, this is the, you know, every famous case in the past 150 years has been in the Old Bailey. And it's a lovely place to visit. So, but I got that same feeling. You have this Irish lawyer, and it's everything about this book is fantastic.
Thank you. I'll have to do that. It sounds fascinating.
Well, and you know, when you get the behind the scenes look, that's wonderful, because they will take you. I'm sure they all read your books.
I hope. Yeah, there's a big push going on, and I am well read in England, and they do love legal thrillers.
Oh, they do. As a matter of fact, you need a book signing. Just tell them, you know, that your publishers will be happy to send you to London, and really, you know, you can stay there and stay at the Savoy, please. And
yeah, they have some wonderful conferences over there. I'd love to go over. I've done Paris, and I've done Barcelona, and I've been over in Frankfurt, but England, that would be a kick. That would be a lot of fun.
Thomas and Mercer have an office there, by the way. I'm sure I remember that. And you have to go, and you have to stay at the Savoy and go to the Old Bailey and meet the solicitors there. They will just love you, and because they're reading your books, and maybe they're looking trying to get some ideas from you now.
Fabulous. I will have to do that.
Well, I'm already working on more promotion ideas for this wonderful book.
Thank you. I appreciate it.
Well, you know, what can I say about you? It's every once in a while I get one of these interviews. Well, all I can keep saying is compliment, compliment, compliment. What am I going to do? And I don't really care if you write with pencil or, you know, or you use a computer. That's not what my listeners are interested in. My listeners want to care about the author. And so tell us something about yourself that you want people to know about you. I think one of the things I do want people to know is that you're well known in the industry as a very giving person, a very warm person. Everybody well, I talk to always says that you're very special.
Well, thank you. That's extremely kind. That's the nicest compliment I think anyone could ever pay me. And I think it really speaks volumes to my parents. I'm one of 10 kids. I was raised in a middle-class home, which, you know, we didn't have a lot because we had so much family, but we had a lot of love in that house. And my mom and dad made it special. Our holidays were special. I still remember as a little kid when The Wizard of Oz was on, we would wait until that first commercial, and then my mother would usher us out the door, and we'd run across the street to Mrs. Pilgrim's house so that we could see Dorothy open the door in the Land of Oz in color. We didn't have a color television when I was growing up. So my parents worked very hard, and I'm just very proud of them because all of my brothers and sisters are really quality people, good people. I have a younger brother who's handicapped. He has Down syndrome, so I'm in tune to people that are different, people that have disabilities, and the need for those people to be loved and taken care of. So it's a wonderful compliment, but I'll pass that compliment on to my mom and my dad because I really do believe that it's a learned trait, and they're just two. My father has passed away, but my mother, God love her, she's 90, and she's still around and still doing great, and she's really the motivating force behind everything.
Well, see, that's the kind of thing my listeners want. My listeners connect more with the author. They get really engaged with the product that the author, you know, makes, but they also want to care about the author. We have, for example, I have a whole group of a whole group of women who are fans of Tasha Alexander, and they you know, we'll have a tea party, and they will wear hats for Lady Emily, for her, you know, character. And that's what's important. I love when I get listeners and readers to care about an author, because then they're going to pick up that book. They don't need a blurb, and they don't need to, because one of the terrible things so often, now in your case, you don't worry about it, but so often people will put negative reviews, and even for famous authors they put negative reviews, and then people will say, I'm not going to read that. And that's not what people have to just trust when they find a great author. Know that that author is going to put everything they have into creating a book that is fun for the reader.
I always tell readers that I'm only as good as my last book. You know, the book that a reader picks up might be the first book of mine that they've ever read, and it might be part of the series, it might not be, but it's that first book that they pick up, and so I have to be good every book. There's no taking time out to write something that isn't as good as I can make it, and so I really try to pride myself on creating every book, making it an enjoyable experience for the reader.
And you certainly have with this book. And I, as I said, her deadly game. Oh boy, it is so good. I had to pull out. I will let my listeners know. I had to pull out my chessboard. I have a chessboard actually with the pieces are glass. So I actually had a glass chessboard next to me, I haven't had anyone to play chess with for a while, but I just enjoyed that whole idea, and just everything about the book. It is perfection.
Thank you. Very kind.
So, and again, you are very lucky and very, you know, blessed, as you said, in many ways, but you are very blessed that you have somebody like your editor, and Gracie Doyle. Tell her I'm sure every writer would envies you to have somebody who cares so much about you and knows you so well that she suggested you get back into writing legal thrillers. And boy, you hit it out the ballpark, because it's
thank you.
It is baseball season, and I'm thinking about ballparks.
I have a great team behind me. Gracie is terrific, and the whole Amazon team has really, really gotten behind my work. And you're right. I'm very fortunate. I'm very blessed to have a publisher that believes in me. And they told me once that my job is to write the next great book, and I've taken that to heart.
Well, you certainly did, and you did it with Her Deadly Game, Robert Dagoni, and you have a website. People can go there, and I'm sure they can sign up for newsletters and stuff and find out where you are. You were supposed to be here for my birthday. You were going to be wrapped up in a ribbon. March 28th was my birthday, and you were supposed to be on the program. And then it got canceled, and I was like, oh, my gosh.
I apologize. I was traveling. I was on an airplane, and I told my publicist, I said, if I'm going to make the sign-in in Phoenix, I'll never be able to do it. So I'm glad we got a chance to talk.
And you got to Phoenix, and that is a great bookstore, isn't it?
It is. Yeah. Poison Pen with Barbara Peters.
Oh, it's the best. It's one of the best. And she's lovely, and the bookstore is lovely, so I'm glad you were there. But I was thinking about you on my birthday.
Thank you.
And I will always now think of you as the rat-a-tat-tat author, the one who really just keeps hitting it right and keeps us so thrilled with a legal thriller.
Thank you very much.
Okay. Thank you for joining me today. You are a joy.
Thank you. I enjoyed it very much.
Okay.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye now. Bye. All right. Okay. We're going to play the poem. Let's play, because it is Poetry Month, April, and we're going to play a poem, and then I think my guest is on, so we'll come straight back.
Hi, everyone. My name is Kim Dower, and I'm going to read you a poem called I Wore This Dress Today for You, Mom, which comes from a collection by the same title. It's a book I created that has poems about being a mother and having a mother, and it's a wonderful Mother's Day book, although hopefully the poems will work all year round. This poem is called I Wore This Dress Today for You, Mom. I wore this dress today for you, Mom. Breezy, floral, dancing with color, soft, silky, flows as I walk. Easter Sunday, and you always liked to get dressed. Go for brunch. Maybe there's a good movie playing somewhere. Wrong religion. We were not churchgoers, but New Yorkers who understood the value of a parade down Fifth Avenue, bonnets in lavender, powder blues, pinks, hues of spring, the hope it would bring. We had no religion, but we did have noodle kugel, grandparents, dads who could fix fans, reach the china on the top shelf, carve the turkey. That time has passed. You were the last to go, Mom, and I still feel bad I never got dressed up for you like you wanted me to. I had things to do. But today in L.A., hot, the way you liked it, those little birds you loved to see flitting from tree to tree, just saw one, a twig in its mouth, preparing a bed for its baby, might still be an egg. I wish you were here. I've got a closet filled with dresses. I need to show you. Thank you for listening to that poem. You can find more of my work on my website, www.kimdower.com. And have a wonderful National Poetry Month. Enjoy a poem a day. They're good for your heart and your soul. Thank you so much.
Okay. And thank you, Kim Dower. I love her poetry. And as I said, she's been a guest many times on Joy on Paper. And I will be playing poetry on every program during the entire month to celebrate. And now I'm going to turn to my next guest. And I am really, this is so funny. Well, of course, I enjoy her book, but there's so many other things about her that I really enjoy. So, Patricia Levy, welcome to Joy on Paper, and let's talk about Holly Land.
Thank you so much for having me, and that was such a lovely poem. I really enjoyed that.
She's so good. She is so good. And I particularly love that poem. It's so evocative. And as you are somebody who loves the arts and who loves words, I thought that was a nice poem to play just before you get on the program to talk about your own work, which is really quite amazing.
Oh, you're so kind. Thank you.
Well, of course, you get to use in your new book called Holly Land, which is a love story. And it's nice. It's it's refreshing. They're not teenagers, so what do you want to tell people about Holly Land? And then I want to talk about it. What you were able to do in this book is to use the subject that is your overall big subject. I should introduce you as a PhD. So it's Dr. Levy, who understands a lot about art, and you get to use that also in this book.
That's right. Thank you. So Holly Land is a love story. It's really a light, feel-good celebrity romance. The protagonist is Dee Schwartz, and she's 40 years old, and she is a writer and an arts researcher. And in the opening scene, by happenstance, she meets Ryder Field, who is a famous actor who's descended from Hollywood royalty, and he's known as sort of a bad boy, and he's 50 years old. And they just have an instant connection, and they both lost their mothers at a young age for different reasons, and that profoundly affected both of them. And through that sort of shared loss and grief, as well as the passion they both have for the arts, they fall madly in love. And the book is really their love story. And while writing it, it's also a celebration of the arts. I've spent the last 20 years as an arts researcher in addition to being a novelist, and I've written many nonfiction books about the arts. And this was the novel that I sort of wove it into through these characters, and especially Dee.
Well, it is lovely. It is charming. I found it delightful. I loved I love both of the characters. As you said, he's 50 years old, but he's in some ways the bad boy of Hollywood. They can be pretty old over there, but the nice thing, that idea of falling in love and sort of spontaneous combustion kind of thing, I like, because I fell in love with my husband in an instant. I mean, literally.
Oh, I love that.
In an instant. He walked to the door of my office. I took one look at him, and I was in love. And at that moment, I decided to marry him. He had not yet said a word. He had not yet. That was it. All I needed to know, and I prayed to God that he didn't smoke, because then he would have been out of. I wouldn't have gone.
That was
a deal breaker. Or ever smoke, because you can never trust people who say they stop smoking. And I was so blessed that it turned out he's a pilot, never smoked, was not allowed to smoke in the Air Force around planes in those days, and absolutely hated smoking. That was it. And after that, I knew that was it for life.
I absolutely love that story. I mean, it's a fantastic story. And I think, you know, some people, they love a romance novel, such as the one I wrote, that has this sort of like instant immediate connection. Some readers, it's not for them. They don't like that sort of instant love. But I just think it's because they've never experienced it. So they doubt it, but it's very, very real, and many of us have had it.
Oh, it happens, and you can't believe it. I mean, it took my breath away that it would happen like that, because I was young. I thought, oh, well, you know, you have a lot of boyfriends, you go through it. No, that was it. I just took a look at that, and that's what I liked about the book, and it's so charming in so many ways. And then, of course, the fact that it has a lot of art in it, and a lot of talking about art, a lot of thinking about the importance of art, was so delightful for me.
Oh, thank you so much. I mean, I wrote this novel during the lockdown when the pandemic first started, and, you know, none of us were able to leave our homes for quite a while, and I needed a way to spend my time. And so I wanted to write something joyful because the world was not joyful at that time, so I wanted some escape. And I decided to draw on what I know best for this book and to really weave a celebration of the arts into the book. So there are all kinds of conversations about the arts, and I hope when people read it, it makes them appreciate the arts and the important roles that they play in our life and how inspiring creativity is.
And it's so true. And people don't understand. I mean, one of the things why I like to talk about reading and encourage people to read is that it does change, it changes you, it changes your brain cells. This is what people don't understand, that by reading, things are happening in your brain that you cannot understand, but it's almost magical. The connections and all those neurons that are moving around in there, just sparking away, you know, like a spark of love. But
oh, it's absolutely true. I mean, I've actually written about in my nonfiction work, there's a field called literary neuroscience, which is really the neuroscience of our brains on fiction, basically. So what happens to us when we're reading literature? And the research is amazing. I mean, in a nutshell, they show that when we're reading fiction, our entire brain is engaged, including regions that you wouldn't think would be engaged with reading, such as those involving touch. So, for example, when you're reading a novel and you happen to love it and you can't put it down and you feel immersed, there's actually something physiological happening to you that's real. And there are studies that show this time and again, and that the same thing does not happen when you read nonfiction prose. It only happens when we're engaged with fiction. And of course, there's neuroscience on how our brain processes other arts as well, and it's all very similar. I mean, it basically all says the same thing, that our entire brains are engaged when we're immersed in a piece of art, whatever that art is, and that the impressions last for days. So those activations in our brain last for days. So it's really fascinating. You know, it absolutely, reading changes us. It changes our emotional intelligence. It changes us physiologically. It changes our worldview. So I just love what you do on this show.
Well, one of the things is, and I've been thinking lately about prisons and all of the people in prisons. And what they really need to do is they need to bring them the great books, and they need to have people who read with them, who bring them into the world of reading. Just like I think they should also have more crafts for them to do. I think if you take somebody and give them a lump of clay and you say, make something out of this, and at first they don't know what to do and they don't know how to do it, but clay can talk to you and it changes your mind. You start thinking about things, and if you're given ideas of, you know, maybe copy this, maybe copy that, but all of that opens so many parts of your brain.
Absolutely, there's no question about it. And for people listening, there are many prison book programs where you can send books to prisons, and I myself have done that many times over the years and sent signed books. And you can look specifically in your area if you want. You can look specifically for women's prisons. And then there are other groups, too, that can benefit so much from reading and from fiction. For example, our military, there's a wonderful program called Operation Paperback, where you can send your used paperback books to people in the military, whether they're serving in this country or abroad, and to their families. And I just think all of these different kinds of programs are so important and need to be supported.
Exactly. Now, in your book, Hollyland, which is a great name for the book, not sure it was the first name, but I'm glad that you used it. I think it's a nice name, very catchy.
Thank you.
And tell us about some of the art discussions that you have in this book and why you use those specific discussions.
Well, it starts in the very beginning of the book, one of the themes, and it carries through, and that's is there a difference between art and entertainment? And that's one of the conversations that Dee and Rye have in the very beginning, and it sort of carries through the book, which really, it means, you know, if something is popular, or if we try to make it popular, does that diminish the artistic qualities? Should artists be thinking about audience, or should they not be thinking about audience? And I don't offer any solutions to these. It's just the book poses these questions. And it also asks questions like, who are the real movie stars on the big screen of our lives? Is it really, you know, people from Hollywood, or is it those that we love and cherish the most? And there are many scenes that happen with art around. So, for example, I don't want to give anything away, but there is a scene at the Metropolitan Museum of Art in New York, and the couple goes through some very specific exhibits, and then at the end of the scene, for a pivotal moment, they're standing in front of a specific painting, Circus Sideshow by Seurat, and that was the first painting that Seurat ever painted of the entertainers outside of the circus. So the street entertainers, the street performers, they're people who are doing it for tips and who aren't being paid. And so it was just interesting to put this scene there where you have a, you know, multimillionaire Hollywood movie and TV star, and you have this arts researcher who just has this love and passion for the arts having this discussion of what's the difference between the paintings hanging on the walls in this museum and the street art we saw in Central Park. And so it just raises questions throughout the book about the different roles of arts in our lives, the different kinds of art, how we might look at things differently. And it's really a celebration.
It is. And, that scene, I love. Of course, I've spent hours and hours and hours in that museum and really all the museums in New York. I love, you know, when I was a kid, when I was a teenager, as a matter of fact, I spent my entire junior year in high school at the Detroit Metropolitan Museum of Art.
Oh, wow.
Well, because I skipped school. but the vice principal gave me, they realized that it was really ridiculous, other than to go in for Latin classes and chemistry classes, it was ridiculous for me to go into school because I had read more books than all the teachers combined. So, so by that point in my life, so they just let me. They just let me do what I wanted to do, which is spend my time in the museum. So that year was just immersed. I was immersed in art and had the opportunity also to meet some great artists who were having exhibits there. It changes you so much if you're involved in the arts.
It does. It really does. I mean, I've been very lucky to be immersed in the arts my entire life. I grew up, and my mother is a painter, and there were other artists in my family, and I spent my childhood going to museums and art galleries, theater. I started taking ballet classes when I was 5, which I did for 14 years. I was involved with theater, and I've been doing creative writing and, of course, reading my whole life. So I feel very, very lucky that I've been exposed to so much because it's so enriching in so many different ways.
Well, your books are excellent. Your other books, and for the writers in who are listening, for anyone who's writing, you really have to go and look at Patricia's website. She's got a list of her books there, and it's one of them is called Method Meets Art. And the other one, which is really, you know, it's so important. The Handbook for Arts-Based Research is a great book. Again, writers need to go more into art, understand it better, and use it in their books.
Thank you. Thank you so much. And I have a book, a recent book called Reinvention: Methods of Social Fiction, and it's all about the merging of writing and creative writing practices and other forms of research that we do. And so there's an arts narrative in that too. But I really wrote that book for writers. But I do think that, you know, as writers know, when we're immersed in a story world we're creating, there's this very magical process of discovery that's happening. And that's something that we can experience through all of the arts, whether it's creating it or just experiencing it and consuming it. And it's so broadening. It changes your worldview.
It does. And you write, your nonfiction writing is great. It's very readable, very easy to understand. And really, all the writers out there have to get a couple of your books because there's different ones that you cover different subjects. And they're really great for writers. And then, you know, now that you move to fiction, with Hollyland, what I like about it is it's in a way, it's a very simple story. It's about love.
Yes.
And that, we need more of that. There are times where you just want to take a book and you don't need another serial killer, for goodness sakes. You don't need to get depressed. You need that. Yeah. You need to believe in love. And
thank you. I mean, that's really what I'm trying to focus on in my fiction these days with this book and the others I have coming out in the future, is just to write love stories that fill people with joy and hope and inspiration. And I think there's so much value in that. And it's not for every reader. I mean, some readers want a book that, you know, is like a big movie plot with buildings blowing up and exciting twists and turns. And I totally get that. But that's not what I do. What I'm interested in is these love stories that are really about the relationships and the joy and complexity of love itself.
Exactly. And we need it. You're right. We need it. Sometimes a book like this will just calm you down and also, I think, give people hope. And when I said, you know, that the you know, your characters are not young, and that's, you know, that's what people need. They need to know that, you know, you can be in love at 40 and 50 and 60, and love is there if you reach out for it, if you watch for it, if you take chances of going out and, you know, now that we can get out of the house again, meeting
people. That's absolutely right. I mean, one of the real messages of this book is that, you know, no matter what's happened in your life, there might be magic right around the corner. So you have to go out looking for it. You have to go out searching for that gold dust in your life. And I love that the characters in this book found each other later in life, as many of us do. But it doesn't matter. It could be any age. The point is that, you know, you have to be open to possibility in life in order to experience the best of it.
And you can't sit at home watching reruns of NCIS or some silly comedy and eating ice cream. You have to get out there. You have to be with people. Go to art museums. Take an art class. Take a painting class, a sculpting class. Get out there and find people with sort of interests that will be interesting to you, and you will be interesting to them. I think that's what I got out of Hollyland, that it's a hopeful book that people will say, yeah, you know, there's other things to talk about than all the bad news, and we don't need dead bodies and blood and guts all over the place. We just need to look at some nice art and to think nice thoughts and talk actually. I mean, that's...
Yeah, I mean, I really think that what you know, a lot of us need sometimes is really just sort of a hug, and that's the kind of book I wanted to write. Something that when you read it, it feels like a warm, cozy hug.
Well, you
so
did
it's,
that.
It's, thank you. Thank that. You so much.
Well, you did that very, very, very nicely. And the time is running out, so I have to say bye to you. But I want to tell people it's a lovely book. And you have a website you want people to go to?
Yes, it's patricialevy.com. That's L-E-A-V-Y. And you can find all my links to social media and, of course, to Holly Land.
Okay. Patricia Levy, thank you so much for being on Joy on Paper today. Holly Land is wonderful. And for all you writers, get her other books because you really need them. Again, thank you for being on Joy on Paper today. Bye-bye.
Thank you so much. Bye-bye.
Okay, bye. Okay. Well, this has been a busy hour. We're going to go ahead and play Bria Burton's Book Buzz if we have time here, Ed. Because it's great, and we want to hear it. So.
Hello, fellow sci-fi readers. This is author Bria Burton reporting for Joy on Paper with your science fiction book buzz. Today's communique to galaxies near and far includes a 2022 SF thriller, Upgrade, by Blake Crouch. The novel is available in print, ebook, and audiobook, with stellar narration by Henry Leva. Now, let's download the book buzz. After a mass casualty event that landed him in jail, disgraced geneticist Logan Ramsey hopes to redeem himself by serving as an agent with a gene protection agency. A bad tip leads Logan into a trap, where he's exposed to some kind of virus laced with a DNA-modifying package. In a matter of weeks, Logan's intellect skyrockets. His physique even experiences painful alterations, and he's faster and stronger than ever. He's the victim of DNA hacking, but he's captured and detained at a black site under suspicion of illegal self-editing. When a mysterious visitor breaks him out of the facility, he takes the investigation into his own upgraded hands. Through his ramped-up reasoning and deduction, he discovers an encoded message in his own DNA, which leads him to a person he thought was long dead, and to a decision he doesn't want to make. With all the subtext of a classic Michael Crichton novel, Upgrade is a fast-paced techno-thriller that offers nuanced ethical dilemmas related to gene editing and adds a splash of murder hornets. Author Blake Crouch is a best-selling novelist and screenwriter. His novels include Recursion, Dark Matter, and the Wayward Pines trilogy, which was adapted into a television series for Fox. Crouch also co-created the TNT show Good Behavior, based on his Letty Dobesch novellas. He is currently at work on a new book and showrunning the Dark Matter series adaptation for Apple TV+. This is Bria Burton with your futuristic fiction fix, signing off.
Okay. Thank you so much, Bria. That was wonderful. And we have to say bye right now. All I have time to do is say thank you, Big Ed, for everything today. And he saluted me. I saluted him. Everybody, have a wonderful, wonderful day. Bye-bye now.